Exploring how we can transform our communities in the 21st century with the support of St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Welcome. This is the Community Safety Podcast with your host, Jim Nixon.
Today, the Community Safety Podcast turns its attention yet again to domestic abuse. We feel it's so important that we keep raising awareness from lots of different people around this really important subject, and we look at the right ways that we can eradicate domestic abuse in the 21st century. My guest is a domestic abuse survivor, and based on her own experiences, she set up her own charity to help thousands of people affected by domestic abuse. Take a listen to a snippet of today's interview.
My family unit, my father's family unit, was a little bit different in the sense that we were not taught or dictated or told. There were not conditions in life that we were never sat down and taught, you can't do this, you do this. So I had this embedded values and beliefs that when the abuse was going on with me, what made it difficult, and at that time I blamed myself, is because I couldn't conform, I couldn't change. But what I know now is that I had this embedded values that knew that something wasn't right, that even though I couldn't articulate it, I couldn't put words to it, I could feel it, there was resistance.
It's now time for the Community Safety Podcast.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Nixon, and I've been working in community safety for over 25 years. This podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest as Sue Buhi. Sue is the founder of Anshaw Women's Aid. Sue works with people to empower them after suffering domestic abuse. Anshaw Women's Aid was founded by Sue in 1984 after her own abusive situation and after a woman needed support to stop her children from being taken to South Asia against her will. Since then, the organisation has worked with thousands of women from different cultures across the UK. Welcome, Sue. Thank you so much for agreeing to come onto the Community Safety Podcast.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Just one quick question before we get into the main part of the interview. The name, I've done my research, I do know, but I just wondered if you would just enlighten the audience on the reason behind the name of your organisation.
The organisation is Anshaw Women's Aid. It was we set up as an organisation within a parent company, so we didn't really need to have our own name. But once it started growing with more and more numbers of women coming into the organisation, we felt it'd be nice for the women themselves, the service users, to give a name. And out of thousands and thousands of names, they chose Anshaw because Anshaw means, it's a word that speaks to warmth, growth, gifting, accepting, protection, safeguarding. So Anshaw is actually, you know, in the South Asian communities, Jim, like when women wear saris or scarves, the edge of that scarf or that sari is called the Anshaw. And that Anshaw is in religious terms and in spirituality and also generally in life is used to open that Anshaw up to accept gifts, but it's used to protect children. It wraps around children. So basically, in today's terms, wrap around, warmth, safeguarding, we're here to protect you, it's protection. It's a word, it's a name that the women themselves chose. And also in most of the South Asian languages, it's quite a common word that can be understood by all. Because sometimes in different South Asian languages, you can't match, you don't have the same understanding. So that's where the name Anshaw came about. And there were very few organizations at the time we were established. And we did further along think, is it time to ask women, is it appropriate for today's term? And the decision was, because so many people know us, we stick to this. It works.
I think it's brilliant. What a great name that has so much meaning and is so linked into what you're doing in terms of protecting women and families. That's absolutely brilliant. I love that. Thanks for explaining that. I'm sure some of our listeners would know what it meant, but when I looked at the research, I thought, I think it's just worth asking Sue just to explain that, because I think it puts some real context into the really great work that you and the organisation are doing at the moment and will continue to do. So we always start the interview, Sue, just I always think it's a great idea to just get to know our guests a little bit more. And I know, obviously, you don't originate from the UK. So just wondered if you would give us a bit of an insight into your background and your growing up years.
Jim, I was born in Kenya, in Africa, Nairobi. That was a long time ago.
I won't ask your age, Sue, don't worry.
Yeah. So that's had some wonderful childhood experiences in Kenya, in Africa, a totally different lifestyle, a country which is really, for children especially, very open space to play, to explore, to grow, different communities coming together, very multicultural. Wonderful experience that has stayed with me, and now with my children and my grandchildren, it's an inheritance that I'm proud to have. The family is originally from India, from the Punjab. After the age of 8, I moved to India for a couple of years. Those couple of years, I picked up different cultures, different learning, different ways of learning, exploring. It's the experience of, you know, so I see my grandchildren worrying about moving from one school to the others. You know, we see young children fearing so many things. And it was also an overcoming of a challenge, moving from one country to another, new friends, moved to the UK, another new learning. And I've actually been in the UK since the age of 10. I didn't move from here. So that's my background. So three different countries, three different cultures, really diverse ways of living, meeting so many different people, different backgrounds, different beliefs, values, and actually celebrating everything. So I would say it's a rich background.
That's a great rich background. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. That is, yeah, like you say, Kenya sounds absolutely awesome. I've been to India. India was a great experience for me, and I can totally resonate with that. But yeah, what an interesting sort of initial bit of your childhood. Yeah. And which bit of the UK did you settle in?
When I first came in, my grandparents were already here for many years. They were here long before us. And they were by the Thames in Woolwich, Greenwich.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where the family initially settled. Yeah, so when I first, I have a very vivid memory arriving in the UK, in Woolwich, and my grandfather said to me the first day, come on, I'm going to show you the ocean, I'm going to show you the sea. And he took me to the Woolwich ferry. bought me a Kit Kat. So I never forget a Kit Kat. I never forget threepence, because the Kit Kat was threepence, three pennies. And the ferry, it wasn't actually the sea, it wasn't actually the ocean, but to me, to a little girl, that was wonderful.
It certainly was, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. Just moving forward now then, Sue, obviously, and the reason probably we're here today really is that you obviously grew up in the UK and experienced some domestic abuse later on in life. Now, I know I've already checked with you that you're okay talking about this, but I just wondered if you could tell me about what happened there. You know, tell me the account of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that too was, I think, talking to you now seems like a long way back, but domestic abuse is an experience that it doesn't matter how long ago it was. It doesn't actually disappear. It does have an impact. And you can choose, you know, after the initial impact, that how you're going to use that effect, which way, which direction your life can go. I believe I was brought up by parents who were very social, very open. I was the eldest grandchild, both from my father's side of the family and my mother's side of the family. So there was no experience of abuse. I'd never witnessed a relationship that was, to me, not normal. Fathers take care of their children, mothers nurture their children. Uncles and aunts with really good relationships, both grandparents, really good relationships. So I wasn't expecting anything other in life. I married a doctor, and even expected even less expectation that anything would go wrong. It was an emotionally abusive relationship, and I think what made it worse was because these were experiences I had never had. I didn't have any knowledge. I wasn't really sure what it was that I was going through. It was the unknown. So it was an emotion that I was experiencing, and the infliction, the impact was isolation, belittling, derogatory comments, putting my family down, calling me names, not allowing me to go to, say, for example, to go and have a swim at the local health center. They felt, the family felt, that it wasn't a thing that was allowed in our culture. So everything that I had experienced in life was not allowed. And the extended family were also quite abusive. And it took me, I think, a long time after separation that I realized that that was abnormal. I kept blaming myself. There is something I'm not doing that's right. Am I requesting or wanting things that's out of alignment in the South Asian culture? Is there something my parents didn't prepare me to work with, to understand or to accept? So for a long time, I blamed myself and I kept quiet. I didn't have a voice. And my ex-husband, having contacts because he was a doctor, he exerted his power over the powers that he, with the powers that he did have, he practiced that control. And one of the examples is when I really started begin to realize that this is, whatever's happening to me is really awful. The word domestic abuse did not enter my head. The word abuse did not enter my head. I just felt totally awful, alone. And I felt that I couldn't speak to anyone because I couldn't explain what I was going through. I became pregnant, and I was taken by my ex-husband to the local, to the GP, and he had already spoken to the GP. I remember sitting there. There was a form in front, both myself and my ex-husband sitting on one side of a table and the GP sitting on the other side, but the conversation wasn't with me, the conversation was with my ex-husband, and totally excluded from there. A piece of paper was then pushed to me, to my side, and said, okay, you can sign that. So I signed it. By this time, I was so, I was so controlled by the extended family and the ex-husband, totally through emotion, through emotional and coercive control. I did whatever I was told, and I felt that I had no one on my side. So it was a moment where I felt, I just give up. Whatever's going to happen for the rest of my life is dictated by this. And the threat when I came back with my ex-husband was, that was a form that I signed to have an abortion. And he said the condition was, if I had an abortion, he would then, there's a chance he would take me back. If I did not have an abortion, I'll go back to my parents. Now, here's what where the difference is with domestic abuse, having, there's so much more awareness. In the 70s, in the South Asian communities, very few women opted for divorce. Very few women went for separation. Very few families were able to deal with the consequences of having a daughter at home that is not married, and even worse, a daughter that is pregnant and having at home. So what the community thought was, there's no chances of remarriage. And in the 70s, there were very few clinics where abortions took place. So I was sent to, from where I lived, to London at my parents' house. Here you are, here's a check. I've organized everything. And being a doctor, it was so smooth for him to do all of that. And I think that's when, I'm so grateful that when my father, the first thing my father said to me was, he took one look at me. He said, that's not the daughter that I sent to that household, the daughter that I married off. This doesn't look like the same person. So my father was in shock. So he didn't ask me any questions. And the best thing that happened in my life at that moment, he said, hey, I've got a cup of tea for you. And I think that sort of just sort of swept through me that I am safe. Here's my father, and here's my father saying, have a cup of tea, no questions, nothing. And next morning we sat down and he said, I explained the situation, and he said, you tell me, what is it that you want to do? So in the South Asian communities in those years, if you're told by your husband or your in-laws to do something, you do it. And the parents of the girl will have fear and no control over that decision making. But my father said to me, I want you to think very carefully. You've got 2 days to this abortion. Do you want to go through this? Do you not? And I want you to know, if you don't, I can feed you for life, and I can feed your child for life, and I can look after you. You've got no fears around that. So you choose, having that knowledge. I chose not to have an abortion. I have a very beautiful 41-year-old daughter now, who's in a really good position, works with domestic abuse, works in the work sector, violence against women and girls, and makes does a lot of decision making, you know, works around policy. So I'm really proud that was one decision. But because of that decision, my assessment said, you can't come back to this house because you chose. Had I stayed in that household, I don't know what my life would have been like. So when I look at domestic abuse, I feel that there has been a lot of awareness. In one way, things are still the same, but in another way, much has not changed about the impact. Women just suffer in different ways, and perpetrators abuse in different ways. As we move, they move their techniques, and as we move, we create more barriers for women to be able to escape those situations. So for me, I didn't think that I'd be working in the women's sector, and I'd take up the issues of domestic abuse. It's just the experience. I think it's the fact that here was my father, who also could have suffered and did suffer in the communities because he decided to support me and not go with cultural norms. And he was, my uncles, my aunts, they all said to him, you're doing wrong. You could be shaming the family name. What you need to be doing is sending your daughter back. Let them do as they want. That's the norm. And my father kept saying, no, 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 no. So in today's world, we look at social media and we look at abuse, text, cyber abuse. We look at how communities can dig at each other, how families, how people, how you can be attacked in different ways. In that time, in the 70s, in the South Asian communities, it had the same impact that news like this would travel so fast within overnight, within days. And before, here I was in London, and before I knew it, my father was getting calls from Leeds, from Leicester, from Nottingham, from Manchester, from all over the place, from Birmingham. It's like people, relatives, people that knew. So it gone that fast, because how dare this girl not listen to us? How dare she go against what we say? How dare she make her own decision? And that was the issue. So I think my move into helping women was an organic process. And what drove me was the fact that my father, who lived in the same communities, said, yes, I'm here to help you, and I'm not shamed by it. I'd rather see you safe than lose name in the community. That was the driving force, that because of him, I was able to move forward. So something like Anchal, a place like Anchal, is like a place like my father, who would say, you're not on your own. We're here with you. This is what you can do, and this is what we can get for you. And I think that was the driving force, that had he not supported me, I think my life would have been very different.
What a brave man. I mean, you are also a brave woman, but I've worked in some of these communities in the police, and I know the pressures, even today, you know, that exist in some communities. And for your dad to stand up for you and to, like you said earlier, wrap that love around you and say to you, you know, Sue, you've got food for life, you've got a home for life. Absolutely amazing. Because,
and that's all you need, like you know.
Yeah, that's all you need. And to think that the pressure from family and community that he would have sustained, you know, love, you know, because let's face it, Sue, we know that there would have been certain situations where, with other families, where you would have been sent back, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You'd have been sent back to the husband.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that happens now as well.
Yeah. Get up, get on with it, shut up, get on with it. Yeah. You know, your husband's in charge, and, you know, and the family on his side, do what you've got to do. I interviewed Caroline Good a couple of weeks ago. She was the senior investigating officer in the Benaz Mahmood murder, the honour-based killing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that set of circumstances, she was suffering domestic abuse. She wanted to get out of the relationship. She went back home, and we all know what happened. You know, the family, you know, colluded, and she, you know, she was murdered because of honour. You know, we're talking about a similar thing here, aren't we?
What is honour? What is honourable? It's like, for each person, the interpretation of that honour is different, but you can't go around taking people's lives away from them. And by lives, I don't mean just literally lives, but also their chances of living a good life, simply because that's your belief. So I wouldn't even say it's freedom. It's just every single person, there's a right. We live once, we don't know. But within that life, how much of years are taken away when you don't have your choices? And we should be allowed to make mistakes in life. We should be able to make our decisions in life. We should be able to learn. And like you said, the barriers are, the impact of barriers are just as great today as they were in the 70s for me. So it was a different frame, and the barriers had different levels of impact. So different type of barriers now, different pressures in different ways. So women, South Asian women, are known to be leaving home, as you know, that the cases increase, and we're organizing more and more safe housing for women. That just proves how many numbers are actually trying to move out or move out and escape domestic abuse safely. But we also know that the barriers have the same impact. It's just we move in society, we move in time. But something about that balance that should have ended by now hasn't. We're still facing those challenges. We're still working towards where.
I can remember when I was a young police officer, and I'm ashamed to say this really now, but the way that domestic abuse was treated in the police service when I joined in 1995, you know, and we're talking another 20 years after the sort of period you're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it wasn't taken seriously, but I just don't think we safeguarded very well at all. You know, we literally would just turn up and it would be treated as, you know, it's just a tiff and there's nothing really going on. And we'd just leave the perpetrator with the victim, whichever way that was, you know, whether that was, you know, male on female or female on male, and we just leave them to it, fill out a form, and that'd be the end of it. And when I look back and I look at it now, I can see in some ways why we haven't really moved massively forward. In some ways, it's great that organisations like yours are taking this really seriously and doing some great work to try and eradicate domestic abuse.
So lots of barriers within institutions as well. And as you say, we've moved with greater understanding, but even within that understanding, within institution, there are still many, many barriers. And actually going back to my experience, you just reminded me that we've actually got a helpline at the moment, which we started in 1995 because two young children were killed in a car by lighting the car by lighting fire to the car, and that was a horrendous experience. So the telephone, the vision I have in front of me now is the telephone when I had my experiences. When I did begin to think, shall I call my parents? Shall I tell them what's happening? Because so far, I hadn't told them anything. And the thought that went through my head was, if I did, what would be the impact? What will they think? I wasn't quite sure. I wanted to protect them. I wanted to protect the rest of my family. And I thought if I did that, I don't know where this is going to escalate. And then I thought, if I picked up that phone, you know, those old big gray telephones sets, we didn't have mobiles then. We had a simple old directory. I was in a new environment that if I picked up that phone, who would I dial? And at one time I actually did pick up the phone and I thought, looking through the yellow pages, but I couldn't find anything. I knew if I called the police, but what would the police do? That might escalate the matter, and I put the phone down. I think in today's time there's a little bit more than that, more than the Thompson's directory. We do send out messages that there's so many options. And sometimes, even if you don't want to do anything about the situation, I'd say just pick up their phone and call. There's plenty of numbers up there. Just talk to someone. Just have that starting process. I think if I had got through to the police at that time, it would be a domestic. I don't think, looking back now, I don't think the police would have been able to help. At all.
I don't think so back then, to be honest with you, Sue. I think you probably would have got a very, I hate to say it, but a bit of a lackluster kind of response, really. But like I say, you know, I think things are a lot better now. I think a lot of positive action is taken. and we have moved on to some extent. But like you've already said, I think there's a long, long way to go. Hi, my name's Jim Nixon and I've been working in antisocial behaviour for a number of years. One of the big issues facing antisocial behaviour professionals is how we effectively tackle noise complaints, and you need good tools to be able to do this. One tool that I would highly recommend is the Noise app. I've effectively used the Noise app whilst working in the housing sector and the local authority sector, and for me, it's the go-to tool. There's over 330 subscribing local authorities and housing associations in the UK currently using the Noise app. The Noise app was designed to relay precise information compared to traditional methods. I couldn't run an ASB team without the Noise app now. So if you want more information about the Noise app for a free trial, then contact the team on info@thenoiseapp.com today. Did you, after you obviously stayed with your dad, how long did you suffer any kind of, you know, ongoing issues from the ex-husband, as he is now, and the family? Did it go on for quite a long time?
It was for years. It was, because to safeguard themselves, they had to, shame my character. And there was all sorts of slander, all sorts of false allegations to make the community feel, to understand that I was a very bad person, which is why they had to do this. And they said that I ran away from home, I did this, I did that. So that went on about 5-6 years, I think. I don't know whether it stopped. I don't know whether it stopped even today, because this thing carries with you for life, because it's families and communities. But I remarried and just got really busy in my new life, and I think I stopped listening. But yeah, it went on quite intensely for a long time. It was savage. It was non-stop.
Could break a lot of people, that, couldn't it? You know, that constant sort of, you know, assassination of your character and your family's character. And like I said, you know, your dad, what a guy to stand up and take that on. You know, absolute amazing. I'm in awe. So tell me about the motivation. Obviously, we know about what's gone on with your relationship with your husband or ex-husband. So what was the kind of, when was the light bulb moment for you to sort of look at taking this another stage and set up the group that you've, the organisation that you're working on there?
I think the fact that I grew up in three countries, but also the fact how my father and my mother brought all his children up, there was an embedded feeling. I'd say even from all my cousins, my uncles and aunts, that my family unit, my father's family unit, was a little bit different in the sense that we were not taught or dictated or told. There were not conditions in life that we were never sat down and taught, you can't do this, you do this. So we all, I had one brother, two sisters, all of us are very individual. We all did our own things. So I had this embedded values and beliefs that when the abuse was going on with me, what made it difficult, and at that time I blamed myself, is because I couldn't conform, I couldn't change. But what I know now is that I had this embedded values that knew that something wasn't right, that even though I couldn't articulate it, I couldn't put words to it, I could feel it. There was resistance in my mind, in my spirit, in my body. And I think it's that resistance that made them treat me worse. And it wasn't a spoken word. It's just that I knew this mustn't happen. It's like sitting with the GP. And if you look today, that was a professional collusion of that incident. A GP today, we've done a lot of training with GPs. And if GPs generally did that, it puts a lot of women at risk. Now, that was a GP, and that could have been my moment where the GP could understand and take up the fact is that I wasn't allowed, the GP wasn't allowed to speak to me. The GP could have picked it up and could have said, I'd like to see you on your own, or come back for a blood test or anything, made any excuse. I think that could, that was a point of protection for me. For me, once I'd come back to my parents' home, given that I was pregnant and I was very sick with the pregnancy, so the clarity of thinking wasn't until after my daughter was born. And that's when I started going through the legal processes, and I realized women have to be strong. And as I moved on with life, got married again, it's just the light bulb moment. I just wanted, to come out of the home and restart a working life to get a self-identity. And I picked a community center. I'd never worked in a community center before. I was on reception. And it was a woman that, because it was a community center, the door, it had an open door policy. The doors were always open. And I just found one morning, a woman just ran into the offices, into the premises, really panicking, telling me what had happened, what her husband had done to her, her threat to her two children who were going to be, her husband had said, threatened that he'd take the two children abroad and she'd never see them again. It was the panic. And I said to her, sit down, I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to make, just like what happened with me, I couldn't pick up the phone. This was a moment where I said, I'm going to pick up this phone. I do not know what's out there. Try to call solicitors. Every solicitor I called said that no appointments for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Domestic violence was not something that they dealt with. It wasn't a crime. It wasn't a specialist issue. They would not prioritize it. And then I got through, after I think about 12 calls, I got through to one solicitor, and it was the secretary of the solicitor that made that move. Had that secretary had a different viewpoint, had that secretary answered my call by saying the same things, no, sorry, no appointments, we can't do this, we won't prioritize this. This secretary as a person picked out the tone, the urgency in my tone, and she said, just hold on, breathe, tell me what's happening. And she listened and she said, you know what, just hold on there. And she said, I'm going to talk to my solicitor. She came back within minutes. She said, come over now. And this solicitor was about 15 minutes away from the community center I was working in. Took this woman to the solicitor. And this woman I'd seen at 10 o'clock in the morning. I looked at my watch at 2 o'clock and I was sitting in the High Court of London that same day. And the children were made wards of court. They were being protected. And coming back on the bus with this woman, and I think that was the thing, I thought, wow, this woman is a different person because she feels safe, because she's got a piece of paper that says her husband cannot do anything. She's been able to talk to me where I was telling her, you don't have to fear him. And this was me having gone through all of that experience. And I'm telling another woman, you don't have to go through this. And I think that was the moment on that bus where I thought, yes, people don't have to go through this. And I questioned myself, why did I go through it all of that time? It's the lack of knowledge. It's the lack of, you know, people that tell you the opposite thing. So I think for me, it's that moment coming back on the bus. It's power of knowledge, power of raising your voice, and power of having that belief and saying, I'm not going to go through this. I don't deserve it. So I'm not going to go through this.
It's sad in a way, isn't it, that you had to go through that horrendous period in your life to, you know, because experience is a lot of things in life, isn't it? You know, we all make mistakes and we learn by those experiences. And it's just sad that you've had to experience that to now be in a great position where you help so many people. But, you know, sometimes things happen for the right reasons, and you know, luckily it worked out to a point for you. But I'm just thinking about all the incredible people now that you're helping. Tell me about the organization as it is today. You know, how many women and people are you helping now every year?
We're always busy. We're busy because whilst we've grown, unfortunately, charities have to function as a business. Somewhere along the Rhine, you know, near the year 2000, it was required to build the big frameworks that were different. Unfortunately, they eat up a lot of time of the organization's work, of the bureaucracy, the administration that has to be done. And I feel that takes a huge part of the hours of the day away from helping people directly, but I also understand that's there for safeguarding, that's there to make sure that we are our conduct and we're working against best practice and we're working within frameworks. So the number, due to that and due to the funding concerns, the numbers that we reach vary year to year depending on how much funding we have and how many staff we have employed through that funding who can reach more women and the volunteers that support the organization. So for example, when there was a 6-year period, we had a bigger bid and we were reaching 2,600 and over women in a year, and we had 12 staff. Today, we only have 3 frontline staff. And the women that we reach are on an average 1,500 through the frontline services. But there's a huge number of women that come to us through the informal networks. The people, is having that capacity to be able to listen to people, for us to retain the tone we had when we set up in the 80s, not to forget that we're there because of that woman that calls us, of that child that needs our support. So within that, there are more people that we reach by setting up informal structures like support groups, having a helpline, giving different numbers for the drop-in so that women can just speak. So where I was in the 80s, the quality of the service was different because we were in a different place, and that meant our horizon to offer that support could be as wide as possible. There was no limit to it. There was nothing that was stopping us saying, no, you can't go to the school and speak to the head teacher and bring children out of the school because there's a perpetrator threatening. There's laws around that. We can't do things like I would take my car and I would protect children. I would go to people's homes and I could help them shift homes. And there's a lot of difference from that quality to today's quality. But also today there's more organizations and there's more structures, which means that it becomes like it's so easy for services to become like a conveyor belt system. So once women report, they've got to go through all the different systems. So what we're doing at Anchal is understanding that we're giving different avenues of support. For example, our empowerment groups, our support groups, learning projects, but also allowing people to volunteer with us. So I think I did a statistics count a few years ago, and at that point it was over 40,000 women that we had supported. That was direct support, and there's also indirect supports, the families that get involved, and the families also being supported within those systems.
That's a lot of lives that you've saved there, Sue. A lot of lives have been changed through the work that you and your staff have done over the years. And I presume now, with the because of the funding cuts and what have you, when you sort of say about, you know, people coming in that you're not maybe helping full time, I presume because of the wider network now, you can kind of signpost them out to other organisations.
Yes, we have to use the partnerships really smartly, so that the person that's coming to us are supported in the best way possible. You can't, we can't, and I think the truth is that no one organization can support one person fully when there's so many experts out there providing different services. What women need is that connect. They just need to know. What we mustn't miss is that there's somebody that's holding their hand, and that's the one thing that we have to make sure. So for example, before the funding cuts started happening around about 2006-07, there were lots of funding changes previous to this, that there was a growth in the voluntary sector, and as the voluntary sector grew, there were different organizations, and when women went to those organizations, they stayed with them for a long time for different things. So the people, the caseworkers in each organization would be their go-to person. So that person didn't have to be the one that did everything for them, but that was the one that was holding their hand. And I think with the funding cuts, that went out the window, and domestic abuse increased, because whilst the funding wasn't there, whilst the charities closed down, whilst grassroots organizations diminished, and the type of support that the communities and people received wasn't there anymore, there was a period where there was no research. And I think we were just, the governance is just sort of pushing, having had made new decisions, well, we'll go with it, cost-cutting measures. And then suddenly the numbers had risen so much that before you know it, that we're sort of dealing with a new crisis. And so we, you know, more money into more organizations, reinventing, looking at what else can we do differently. But we're also wasting a lot of time, because whilst we keep making different decisions that are being made because of the financial and the economic situations, we're having to spend more because the crisis, we've allowed the crisis to happen, and there's more and more women who are experiencing abuse. But there are many women who are too frightened to come out and speak, because there's a huge framework, and they are frightened. They're frightened if they have children, that the social services will pick up their issues, and the social services will threaten to take their children away from them. There's all sorts of fears, and there's repeat situations that women going back to that cycle of abuse, because life is very difficult to cope with once. So even if they've gone through that system and they come out the other end, there's not enough services to hold them in that space to remain independent, to remain resilient. That doesn't exist. There's a huge gap there. So what happens is, if women can't continue financially, that financial stability, bringing up children, other issues that come up in society, and sometimes women just say,
they just get dragged better back,
with the
they?
Yeah, the better with the they devil you know than the devil the you
don't. Yeah, I was talking to a survivor a couple of weeks ago, and that's exactly what they said, and I said this as well. You know, it's very easy sometimes, again, like, I'll put my police hat on. Yeah, you just say, oh, why don't you just leave? It's just not that simplistic, is it, Sue? It's not that simplistic, no. Just to go, just move on. And it's, you know, don't go simple. Back to him. It's just not that simple. No, it's so complex.
No, you
complex,
can develop all these strategies that you can put different frameworks, all of that. But in reality, life is real. Lives are real, and it's not. You're talking about police as well. What we find as an example, like the secretary who took on the case because she connected with what I was saying. Similarly, even within the police force, it depends on who at the front line, who you get first, what sort of relationship you have. So we do build good relationship, and we have found lots of really excellent police officers who really go out of their way to help us. We, on the other hand, we have had police officers, it could be, so we say we need something that's culturally specific. So we've dealt with police officers from South Asian police officers who've actually hold their own judgments and values about their cultures. For example, we had a young woman who'd left home, well, who was thrown out of the home. She had no recourse to public funds, and she needed her passport and her clothes back, went to the police, and the police officer sat there, spoke with her. He said, "You know what? If I were you, I'd think again, because I've gone and spoken to your in-laws and your husband. Do you know they've got that many properties? And do you know they don't sound that bad at all?" She could have gone back. She didn't, but she could have. That's not her experience. So it depends on people in different professions. And I think the collaborations need to be greater at the front line, because that's where the work happens.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when the funding is so small, I've said this before, you guys just can't work in isolation, can you? And I know some organisations want to do that, but I just think this is a key time now where to continue to help as many victims as possible and their families, you know, there's got to be a rethink, hasn't there, around how we all collaborate together to get the right service for a rising, I mean, look at COVID at the end of the day, Sue. COVID has been an horrendous period for people suffering domestic abuse, hasn't it? The numbers are rising every day.
Every day, in the first week, in the first 2 weeks, we had a 30% rise. But crazy. The intensity of their experiences is greater. They're in a sense of confusion economically, because perpetrators losing businesses and jobs, because their businesses and jobs and employment, it wasn't registered. So not having that stability, that's increased from the perpetrators trying to come back into family homes, making women and children feel they need them. Children being at home, being manipulated by perpetrators, that children saying they need their fathers because the father's got money, on the other hand. But needing children out of boredom, presence, extended families, and manipulation around that. We've had so many cases where extended families have come into the situations and talking about forced marriages and arranged marriages with very young children. And we've had mothers who are calling us, "This is happening, the pressure is there. How do I get out of it? How do I get out of it if, say, for example, someone's 16-year-old young daughter has been manipulated by grandparents from the father's side who are saying that we've got this young boy for you in Pakistan or in India and he's really suitable for you, and a 16-year-old girl has built up a dream world around this. So if the young girl agrees with the grandmother, the mother can't do anything about this, because it's the stress on that young person about all sorts of things that have been happening during the pandemic. So there's sort of multiple effects of the pandemic, and here we are trying together as whole partners trying to cope with it and trying to make sure that we deliver services in a better way. And I feel there's a lot of listening happening at the moment. There's a lot of conversations, and it's I'm glad that's happening.
Good.
Because we do need to talk about it. Yeah.
That's so good to hear. And that's music. You know, that's what this podcast is all about as well, that we share this across a number of partnerships as well, to so people can listen to this in your profession and realise that, you know, we've got to start collaborating more if we're going to make things better, I think. One question that I wanted to ask you, Sue, before we wrap up. Do you think, I've always thought this, but do you think we need to do more work with offenders?
That's always been a question. I think I've been asked that lots of times, and there's all sorts of opinions around there. So when the perpetrators projects first started coming out around about 2009, they've started with anger management, and there's a lot of opinion that perpetrators learn, and it's my experience as well, learning from the women whose perpetrators have gone on perpetrator programs, that say, for example, anger management, they haven't actually learned to manage the anger. What they've learned is to learn the tools and techniques to hide the abuse better, and tools and techniques to escape convictions. So it's like having the velvet glove. So I'd have liked to say that these programs work. So, and at the same time, I've run projects where we've worked with young boys. And I was quite shocked to find out that young boys, whether there's a background of domestic abuse or not in the families, it's the relationships between girls and boys that you can see the different attitudes and behaviors of the young boys. So I can see the next generation, different type of abuse that's happening. So something, some cycles not happening. But if there were programs for offenders, I think they should be run by grassroots women's organizations. So they can monitor, they can evaluate, they're speaking the language to the perpetrators, to the offenders, that says that men suffer as well as women. If we take perpetrators, for example, once, whether there's conviction or not, their life, when women take action, their lives change as well. And I've seen many cases, numerous cases, where after the woman's been rehoused and the children have moved on, and the children don't want to know the abusive parent and the struggles of contacts and all of that, there comes a time, and being in this world for so many years, I've seen generations that have grown up and come back and shared their stories with me, how they've grown, but where perpetrators have become ill because they're isolated, families don't want to know them. So in different ways, they suffer as well. So why inflict that suffering on yourself simply because while you're inflicting that suffering on someone else, you feel you're in control, but you're not really. So I feel offenders programs should be run by women's organizations, and especially grassroots organizations, so that the message is clear, so that the impact is what we would like it to be, so that they don't offend. Not only do they not offend, but also they don't want to offend. Their understanding of life is very different. I think I always look at things. So over time, I experienced my own experience and pain through that. And then to be in this place for that many years, you're picking up so many thousands and thousands of families and women and children's pain. I've been trying to sort of look spiritually, not just so we have facts and figures and strategies, we work it through, but there's something that's not tangible, something else that happens. So I've been trying to look at that and try and see the person behind the person, that actually what happens is that with all actions that people take, from their point of view, they're doing it from the best of what they feel is right. So the challenge is, whatever anyone feels is right, they have no right to be abusive. There's no right for anyone to abuse anyone else. It doesn't matter what you feel, what you believe is right, and how can we process that ingrained thought, that behavior. And I've also looked at, I do neuro-linguistic programming, and I also say, for example, I speak with the women and say, you have three children, for example, and it's to understand that each person filters information in a different way. When that filter that information, so you could be the same mother, three children, something happens at the same time, and you say something, or they absorb what's happening in the environment, but once it goes in their filtration system, they take it, each child is taking in information differently. So by the time their behavior happens, it's in according to how they've processed that inside, and that's what how the behavior is, and that behavior then projects and changes what happens in the environment. It's like how can we work with people to try and understand? I don't think there's enough research done on perpetrators. During the Olympics, I took up a 2 years project where I was researching. I wanted to find out from all the women that came to the service a perpetrator's profile, because during the Olympics they were real fierce, because we were based in Stratford as well at that time. What if the domestic abuse situations increase? Let's look at the profile. So the profile, what the perpetrators looked like, their persona, most of them, were they in unemployment? Were there alcohol issues? Was there substance misuse? Was there unemployment? And who are these perpetrators sitting with? This is what's the groups of people they're sitting with. And what we found, but they were also sort of different gangs in different areas of the borough, and the different friendships. It's like an environment that perpetrators stuck with is the people who believed the same thing. So they were not with people who could challenge them with their behavior. So there were certain profiles. I think it's a big piece of work, working with the
society family. Needs to play more of a role in this, doesn't it? So I was thinking about this the other day, and I think there's got to be start to be like a stigma attached to domestic abuse. You know, I think sometimes, like you've just said, there's like, within certain groups of people, there's like an acceptance to it, isn't there? Oh, well, it's fine, it's acceptable. But I think society needs to start being a lot more non-accepting of people that commit domestic abuse. And, you know, we need that stigma, you know, so
yeah,
that...
Yeah, transfer that stigma.
Yeah.
You know, from women that suffer to...
To positivity, you know, so it changes.
Yeah.
We're coming to the end now, Sue, and I just wondered, is there anything, any question you wanted me to ask you that I haven't asked you that you just want to cover before we wrap up?
Now, we've had a nice long chat, haven't we?
It's been great. You've been absolutely brilliant.
So many different things, but I think there's a space and time for everything. For example, the bills that are passed, the laws that are passed, and you struggle to get consultations and information through. Not all of them is passed. So I think we need to be listened to more, because we're not pushing for change in law just for the sake of it. We're pushing for it because there's a need for it, and just having, you know, that space for that voice to be heard. And I think
it's there ultimately to safeguard and protect and to save lives, isn't it? And that sort of, you know, needs to be changed, you know, moved into proper reality. Sue, I've really enjoyed this. I think you're doing some amazing things. Thank you so much from me and from the audience for everything you do, because you literally are saving lives with your staff every day. Keep up the amazing work. I'm in awe of you. Thank you. Thank you to our audience as well tonight for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. We really do appreciate your support. Please like, rate, and subscribe to the Community Safety Podcast. We really want to get our mission across to as many people as possible. So tell your friends, tell your colleagues, and we'll catch you on the next episode. That was an incredible interview with Sue Boohey. Sue is so open and honest, and actually that is the first time she's publicly shared those horrific experiences with anybody, and I'm just in awe of her, and I'm so grateful to her for coming on to the Community Safety Podcast and being so open and honest. She's doing some amazing work now with her own charity, and we should all look to support that where we can. Thank you so much again for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. We really do appreciate your support. Please rate, subscribe, and review the podcast. It is so important that we spread the message. So tell your friends, tell your colleagues. And also don't forget our website, which is www.thecommunitysafetypodcast.co.uk. We will catch you on the next episode.
You've been listening to the Community Safety Podcast. With thanks for support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Join us again next time to help us explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century. On the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.